welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm your host, Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. Our 52nd issue has just begun mailing to everyone around the world. If you haven't joined us yet, hit us up at fretboardjournal.com by clicking on the subscribe button. You can either get the digital edition or our keepsake print edition. Either way, you're going to be loaded with great guitar stories and photo essays you're not going to find anywhere else, including a ton of great interviews that aren't on this podcast. And it's a great way to support all that I do and all that our little team here in Seattle, Washington does. So on the podcast today, I'm talking to Saltwater Hank, a musician, a folk artist, and a singer-songwriter from Prince Rupert, British Columbia, which is basically closer to Alaska than Vancouver and Victoria and what most of us think when we think of British Columbia, Canada. He just released a gorgeous, groundbreaking album on Canada Day, July 1st, 2023. It is a country record, but the entire album is sung in Sumalik, the language of Saltwater Hank's ancestors. It's a wild story. Saltwater Hank is awesome. I got to ask him all about it, how he wrote these songs and in what language they originally were written in, and how we as a society at whole can better honor First Nations and Indigenous people. I think it's a great chat. I did my best here and I wanted to learn as much as possible and share it all with you. I will not attempt to botch the title of the album, but if you search for Saltwater Hank on Spotify or anywhere else you stream stuff or Bandcamp, you will find it. Before we get to that, our podcast is sponsored by iZotope. You can get 10% off iZotope with the discount code FRET10. We are also brought to you by StringJoy Strings. Get 10% off of your first string order from StringJoy with the discount code FRETBOARD when you check out. Pegghead Nation is also offering our listeners your first month free or $20 off of any annual subscription with the promo code FRETBOARD when you check out. And Daring Banjos is back, daringbanjos.com. Hopefully you tuned into that Alison Brown episode we just did. If you haven't yet, check it out. But let me just say, Daring is making incredible instruments at all price points, from the Good Time Starter Series of banjos on. I love this brand. And our 2023 Fretboard Summit, of course, you know about the summit, right? It's my brainchild. It's my baby. It is in Chicago, August 24th to 26th, 2023. The summit is a handmade guitar show with 50 of the greatest luthiers, amp builders, and pedal makers from around the world showcasing their wares that you can buy. It's also a three-day festival of all things fretboard and guitar, with performances from Tommy Emmanuel, Jorma Kekkonen, Jeff Parker, and so many others. I've got Bill Frizzell teaching a workshop, leading a guitar orchestra that anyone, including you, can join. We've got JHS's Josh Scott conducting an Iron Chef-inspired battle where two pedal makers are going to build the ultimate fuzz in front of an audience in an hour's time. We've got workshops, we've got lectures, we've got guitar history classes, and so much more. If you want to geek out with us, go to fretboardsummit.org and come to Chicago. It's open to all abilities, all levels, and it's made specifically for folks like yourself who enjoy these podcasts and the magazine and all that I do. It is a fun 3 days of guitar geekdom. And if you're listening to this show, you are qualified. Come to Chicago. You're going to have a blast. Just register at fretboardsummit.org. All right, we are going to get to my episode with Saltwater Hank. I hope you enjoy it. Again, his new album is out on all the streaming platforms right now. Saltwater Hank, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast.
Thank you.
You've got a record coming out on Canada Day, which for our American listeners is July 1st. Which we're going to get to. It's blown my mind. But before we get to that, let me hear a little bit about your background and where you grew up and sort of when music entered the picture.
Yeah, so my background, I am a Tsimshian person living in Tsimshian territory. The unceded land of our ancestors is on the northwest coast of what has been briefly called British Columbia, Canada. And we occupy a territory that stretches from the southernmost part of Alaska, which is a place called Dakwan. That's Annette Island. That's just a short ferry ride from Ketchikan, all the way south to a place called Klemtu. That's our southernmost village. So I'm born, I was born in Japan, which is a place that describes where there's foam on the water as a result of the tidal rapids surrounding the island here. And but on a map, it's Prince Rupert, BC. And I began doing music for just for the magic of it when I was 11 years old. And I'm fortunate enough that I come from a musical family. My dad and I were just playing last night. Actually, we were playing some old country tunes and having a nice time. Yeah, you know, like kind of been surrounded by the whole family band situation, my whole life growing up, and yeah, just have been very lucky to have grown up with music.
Yeah. Being a member of the First Nations, like, I think probably means different things to different people, just as, you know, it does for folks here in America. You could live on a reservation, you could live off a reservation. There's all sorts of different experiences. How much of that culture was part of your childhood, and you know, how Western I don't even know. I want to be sensitive to how I describe this, but like, what was your setting like?
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting with the whole the intergenerational effects of residential school on our family and on every single Indigenous person in North America. And as a result of that, my first language growing up was English, and I wasn't immersed in the culture nearly as much as I have done so on my own accord now growing up, because you know, my dad never spoke the language, my mom never spoke her language either, and it took until I was about 16-17 to get really, really into it. I started asking my grandpa. He was the closest person that I had for cultural reference, cultural knowledge, and knowledge of our language. Even though he did go to residential school and he did lose a great deal from that, but still maintains to this day. I mean, he's like 89 years old now, but is able to converse in some Ayalach with peers, other old folks. But yeah, it's a lot of Indigenous people of this generation and younger are kind of embarking on these journeys now of sort of rediscovery or reconnecting, that people call it, reclaiming what was ours, being immersed in the culture, being you know, learning as much as possible about our territories, where people harvested things, all the protocols and laws around that, all the traditions, and the language, which is the hugest part in my life that I've connected to and I've put a lot of energy into.
Yeah. You said that your grandfather speaks this language with some of his peers, but was this something that you ever overheard growing up, or did you have to kind of go seek it?
Yeah. Like, I mean, those sounds were there. I think that's, I put credit towards hearing some words and phrases growing up from him, which contain sounds that are not present in English or in any of the Latin languages. And hearing that at a small age, I think, has allowed me to learn the language quicker, which I'm pretty lucky to do. But it was it's an interesting thing, the language disconnect between generations, it's interesting because I'll hear him speak to other people fluently. And then, but yeah, with us the grandchildren with his own children, it wasn't a priority. It was, and that, comes from the residential school system of wanting to really westernize the indigenous population. It was just some handfuls of phrases growing up, and that's all I ever heard until I really started making a convert, a conscious effort to learn it from him and ask him more questions about it.
When you say that there were, when you say that there are people of your generation who are like seeking out the culture again and wanting to immerse themselves back, was there a role model, or was there like a person that you emulated, or did you just kind of all decide collectively kind of around the same time, like, we need to not have this culture go away?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like that, I think it just becomes like, it's a matter of education, I think. I mean, that's the only thing that I can guess is like, I know what happened for me and what happened for, some people in my family is once we learned of the atrocities that occurred from, our government and the church and things like that, it brought up a lot of anger of just like, why are we not able to, why are we not able to display and know our cultural traditions like we did before, and then having the answers to those, and then going, well, we need to learn about these things. And it's just I think part of it is practical and cerebral like that. Yeah. But I also think there's another layer to it that that can't really be explained by anything. And that might just have to do with like an inherent, like an internal thing that I can't see and I can't understand that is a part of my Tsimshian identity, wanting to reconnect to the ancestors.
Yeah. You said you had a family, or your family had a family band. So what did that music look like?
Yeah. So we play a lot of old country stuff, a lot of old Hank Williams and, Marty Robbins and Johnny Cash and the likes of those, Buck Owens, all the greats from back then, the golden time of country music when it was the best, as I think that was the best time, it was when those guys were around. I think, I heard somebody say it once before that, country music died when Johnny Cash quit hanging out with Waylon Jennings.
Okay.
But yeah, our family band, we play a lot of that. Our grandpa always says that he's his last year. And I think he's been saying that it's his last year since he was 80 years old, and he's 89 now. So, he's probably got another performance in him still. Yeah.
And where would you guys play?
Mostly kind of the ones that I've been a part of for the last, decade and a half or something like that, have been, the Indigenous People's Day celebrations that happen here on June 21st every year. But yeah, we've done smaller things. Mostly smaller shows.
Okay. Are there like honky tonks where you live and dive bars that have live music?
I wish. Yeah. But it's mostly community halls and things like that. Just whatever events we played. We played some other, fall fairs and stuff like that.
Okay.
Those kinds of things. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause we were talking just a minute before we hit record, and you're like really close to what most of the listeners of this podcast will know as Alaska. Like you're not far from there at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
it's a wonderful place.
Like how many people live in Prince Rupert?
About 12,000.
Okay. Is it mainly fishing, logging, or is there tourism going on? Do you get outside visitors?
Yeah, like we've got a, fishing is still like a thing, but there's a big ugly cruise ship in the harbor right now.
Okay, you get those too.
And not as bad as Ketchikan. Ketchikan has, I think, like 4 or 5 cruise ship berths, and we only have one.
Okay,
thankfully.
Yeah,
but one is enough. That's for sure. Yeah,
and then for 6 hours every day, or every time the thing docks, you're inundated with tourists, or however long it parks.
Yeah. Yes, and yeah. I always keep my horn honking hand ready, because they seem to go quite wild all over the road.
Oh sure, yeah.
Yeah. They put their crosswalk blinders on and
So you've released a bunch of records. I think I saw them on Bandcamp. All for the most part, at least the ones I listen to, in English. Talk to me about this new record.
Yeah. So this one has been in the works for about 5 years. And 5 years ago, I started getting really like into the language, taking it very seriously, making it intentional that I have a goal to be to be totally fluent. I don't know. I started writing, and I would come up with lyrics, and then with the help of a fluent speaking elder, I would translate them and then put music to it and then tour that for a bit and not feel totally satisfied with it. And that kind of process happened over the course of 5 years, until I finally was like, okay, I need to just record these songs. And it's like a stamp of time, such as any art piece, and get them out there.
I mean, what does this look like? Does the elder, I'm assuming it's not your grandfather, or you would have mentioned that. Yeah. Was the elder music savvy, so that you kind of adapted the poetry that you would make in an English language to that language, or how did that all go down?
Yeah, that was the difficult part. And I learned very quickly that, and I only have 2 songs that started in English first.
Okay.
On the record. And the rest were Somaliyah first. And that, I'll tell you why, is that the English language it's not even close to how our language works. And just very musical already. There's a lot of long vowels, and when you're speaking about yourself, it's a U sound at the end, and we're speaking about someone else, it's an N sound. So like, you can just rhyme these words, boom, 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 like over and over again. Whereas, in English, you have to be a little bit more crafty, I guess. Yeah, so that process with bringing it to, so like my first mentor was Terry Lowther. Her name is Huhushk, and from there, and I still would go back to her and be like, is this right that I'm writing? Once I started primarily writing in Somaliyah and not English, I would go to her. I would run it by a few others. Belinda Nelson's one of them. I worked with her quite a bit, and just like, simple grammar mistakes, but yeah. The writing really became a lot easier the more my fluency level was you know, improved upon. Because then I can think in Somalia first, and I can create in Somalia first, and then use those long vowels and the cadence of the rhythm of the language as it naturally is spoken in writing the lyrics.
Sounds like it's just a much more poetic musical language to begin with. So mm-hmm. Do it that way, do it.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, that's not even just like a Tsimshian person being biased and saying that, you know, my own language is beautiful in the way that it is and it's already musical. Is that our neighbors across the Hecate Strait are the Haida people.
Uh-huh.
Their word for us is Kiltla, and what that translates to is the people with the beautiful language.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, you even got an endorsement. I love it.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah.
What was the thought of this is a country record? I mean, there's, you know, it's a country, it's a non-English language country record. And I'm just curious, is that just because country is your medium, or were you making a statement with that juxtaposition there? What was the thought there?
Yeah. So I remember when I was thinking that I should do a Somalia language album, I thought the people that are going to listen to this record and understand every word immediately and not have to look it up are the people that I'm learning the language from, and the type of music that the people I'm learning the language from listen to happens to be the old school country music, which I also love myself. So it's not like something that I was like, oh, I'm going to make a country record for the old people. It's just, yeah, it's the music that I grew up on. And, you know, there was a period of rebellion in my youth where I was like, this music is hokey and lame, and I was listening to punk rock and a lot of metal, and then came around to it again and was like, actually, yeah, this stuff is awesome.
Yeah. You've been working on these songs for 5 years, it sounds like, but what's been the reaction like when those elders who do speak the language fluently, what's their reaction been?
It's been overwhelmingly good. And you know, honestly, like going into showing them the songs, I had a tremendous amount of anxiety. Like, am I going to be pronouncing them right? Are they going to like it? Are they going to think it's, you know, all of these intrusive thoughts were coming into my head? But all of them have just been overwhelmingly supportive and proud. And just like happy that there's somebody sharing the language through this type of medium.
Beautiful. That's super cool. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the release day, because I'm guessing that's not a coincidence that it's on Canada Day.
Yeah. So I was initially inspired by choosing this date by the Heiltsuk people, and they are people who whose traditional territory, who's also unceded, as most of BC is. The Heiltsuk people, they live in Bella Bella. Waglisla is their village name, and they've got a lot of territory around there. But last year, I was invited to perform at this celebration, and the celebration was occurring on July the 1st. And what they were celebrating is reclaiming the fishing lodge that had been occupied by a non-Heiltsuk family for 100 years. It was actually an old base, like a military base. So close to 100 years, I guess. But they had been operating this fishing lodge for that long, and the Heiltsuk Nation bought it back. So it was really promoted as this like piece of this whole land back movement that you see kind of going on all over North America. And the celebration happened on July the 1st. So I performed and, you know, I sang my songs and they did the ceremonial signing of the deed of the fishing lodge and all of the land that's surrounding that. It's a quite a significant area of land. And during this, they sang their Heltzik traditional songs, lowered the Canadian flags that were up there, and then put up their own Heltzik Nation flags. And I thought, wow, this is just so powerful that they're able to do this. And they started saying from now on, July 1st is Heltzik Day for them. It's no longer Canada Day for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, yeah, we can do a lot more things on our own. Like July 1st is just a day. Like it can be Somalic language day, you know, like it doesn't have to be what it is for officially for the country.
This is probably a super touchy subject, but like, how is Canada doing at acknowledging your people and giving you guys the rights that were taken away in the land? Because I mean, from an outsider's perspective, I drive through British Columbia and like all the signs now have the town and in First Nations alongside the English, whatever. And I'm like, wow, this seems more progressive, at least on the surface, as like a tourist. You don't see that driving through mm-hmm. Washington State so much. But are we failing miserably across all of the continent, basically, is the question.
I mean, there's always steps forward taken. There's still a long way to go.
Yeah.
I think municipalities are really, like, they are actively trying, like, at least, like, here, we finally have Somalic language on our welcome to Prince Rupert sign.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says the name, the Somalic name under it. But yeah, it's still like they made this new sign and then Prince Rupert is in these giant block letters. And then underneath is these tiny letters. So it's just still this kind of like overt subordination kind of that is occurring.
Sure.
And then, you know, like, There's still, like the other day, there was a filmed, like multiple people got it on film of five RCMP officers, like with all of their knees on the back of this one man, one Indigenous man in town here, using a lot of force that was totally unwarranted. So these things are continuing to happen on our territories. They just aren't, you know, aren't the, what am I trying to say? I think the superficial looks great.
Yeah.
The fact that they're getting, you know, our place names and languages on signage and things like that and pamphlets and, you know, for the cruise ship people that are coming off, you know, there's this like travel pledge and it's partly in Somaliac and things like that. You know, there's great things like that. But on a political level and on a social level and on a systemic level, there's still a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done.
When you look around, are kids learning this language? Like, are there opportunities opening up that weren't there for you for the next generation?
For sure. And I, in my day-to-day life, I'm working with the Somaliac language team here, who is connected to School District 52, which is our school district. And Somaliac language is being taught from kindergarten to grade 12. And it's not like that everywhere. Like, we're very lucky to, oh, not lucky. It took a lot of fight and a lot of, it received a lot of pushback from the non-Indigenous community here going, hey, you know, like, I don't want my kid learning the native language and blah, blah, blah. You know, that kind of comment was thrown around quite a bit, but our people continued to fight for it and they got it. And now it's recognized on the same level as French as a second language. So once people get to high school, they're able to choose whether they want to take French as a second language or if they want to take Somaliec as a second language. And then now that that's classified as a second language, that, you know, opens up the college and university requirements, you know, being fulfilled, which is great.
Yeah, I'm scared to ask, but for every Somaliec, is there like, are there languages that have just been lost or made extinct in recent history because not enough people paid attention?
Yeah. And yeah, there is one, I don't remember the name of the language, but there has been an Indigenous language that, and I don't think it was in BC, I think it was somewhere else. But, you know, I've been fortunate to work alongside a very well-respected linguist, Margaret Anderson, who has worked with our Somaliec language since the 70s. And I work with her on the day-to-day. And she spoke at this gathering that we had here. And she said, there's always... Her take-home, her big take-home for all of the people there was there's always going to be hope for a language to survive. You know, the Somaliac-speaking peoples are super, super lucky that we still have in flesh and blood living first language fluent speakers. And, you know, it doesn't sound like a lot. There's 72 left. But there was this other language that had been quote unquote extinct, but due to the heavy documentation by anthropologists and linguists of that language, after, you know, the last speaker died maybe 80 or so years ago, thankfully, due to the documentation of it, there is a new fluent speaker today of this language.
Wow.
Because they just studied and studied and studied. Yeah. And it was all written documentation. So they had to know the orthography and, you know, every single sound of each syllable and yada, 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 but they did it. So it's proven that for a language to be, to be revitalized, that there doesn't need to be living speakers, but yeah. Obviously it's very, very helpful to have them.
Yeah. Say the name of the record, your record. And what does that translate to?
Is a bentwood box, and a bentwood box is made out of a cedar plank. Mm-hmm. And they steam each corner and then bend it around. There's no nails or anything like that involved. And then there's like a notch in the final corner, and that keeps it together in a perfect little square. And those were used for holding things that were treasured, be it anything from, you know, dried food or regalia, ceremonial regalia, or other sacred items, a lot of different things. And they were often adorned with crest designs, which are attached to family groups and chiefs and names and lineages. So there's a lot that goes into just the word kalin. And people used to use that quite often. You'll see them in museums mostly nowadays, and people are starting to create new kalin these days. But that's what the significance of the bentwood boxes to us. And then Wuluhalka Limi, that means is full of songs. So it's together they call Hulu Halt Galimi. That means the bentwood box full of songs.
It's almost describing a guitar.
It could be. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, Halimi is a guitar. That's any musical instrument used for singing is what it really translates to. Okay. But yeah, bentwood box full of songs. It's like the people that were able to sing and carry on songs and were treasured, and songs themselves were also treasured and are still today.
Yeah. And if we could, if we did speak this language fluently, like are these songs the classic country song motifs and themes, or is there one overriding theme to this record in terms of like what these songs are about?
Right. I mean, no, in the ones that are country that I've written, though. One of the songs on there, which is called Ndo Yan, I think the subject matter of that song is the most country thing that I've ever heard.
Okay.
And it is the lyrics actually are they're not my own. It's a traditional song that comes from my home village of Talkeetna, that's Hartley Bay. And it came off of a recording, as well as in a little book, a songbook for children. And it was recorded by Violet Robinson. That was my great grandma's sister. And the lyrics translate to, and I'm going to have to think of this on the fly, is go on and walk away. I don't want to see you again. And if you do so much as try to return here, I'm going to shoot you because wow. because you have no heart and no one will ever invite you back. And no one is going to cry for it.
Wow.
And it was called a love song, but it's really hearing a story about the song's origin. It came from somebody who was jealous over a lover that they had lost to someone else. So like, you know, you've got the heartbreak motif, and there's crying in there, and then there's a gun, you know.
Yeah.
A little bit of Marty Robbins gunfighter ballad, you know, like that kind of stuff. So it's all in there.
What do you think the result of this journey you've been on, learning this language, recording this record, refining these songs, like, where do you go from here? Are you going to write songs in English again? Has it changed the way you view your own songwriting?
Yeah, I thought about that, and like, what's the interesting byproduct of immersing myself in Somalic language and writing in it, and just being so involved in it, is it's actually made my English worse and slower to recall. sometimes there'll be a something. And I will forget. I'll forget what it's called in English, but I know what it's called in Somaliac, and I'll have to think for a bit and be like, "What the hell? You know, what the hell? This, what is this berry called? Or like, what is this tree called in English?" It's actually become better for me to just write in Somaliac altogether. But I'll write English songs again at some point. I just know that the thing, you know, the fact of the matter is that the English language is a globalized language, and it is there forever. And what am I contributing if I'm writing in English? You know, there's a lot of people in the world that are writing in English, and the people that you know, want to learn the English language, they have lots of English language material to listen to. Whereas with Somalic language, I care so much about its survival. It is a part of who I am as a Tsimshian person. Mm-hmm. And we as Tsimshian people don't have a great deal of music to listen to in the language. And one of the key components to really revitalizing a language is having everything available in it, you know, with music, film, television, radio, those kind of mediums, having those available. So like, you know, I got a couple of friends over in Kitsum Kalem, Dimsilhait Kabao, and Laksilda over in Kitsum Kalem, who are going to start a Somali language podcast. And then, you know, we got to get that kind of stuff.
It's really interesting.
It's important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What is your, do you have a day job or a side job outside of music?
Mm-hmm. So, I'm really, really lucky to work with, what I call affectionately my grandmas. I have got a job where I get to engage in Somalic language every day. So, I work as a contractor through the Tsimshian Somalic Language Authority, and I work to digitize analog resources to make them available online, restoring audio, translating, transcribing, that sort of thing, as well as recording fluent speakers' voices for our online linguistic database, for our dictionary, and to produce, you know, video content, audio content, that kind of stuff.
That is amazing. My question was, are you able to go through a whole day not speaking English? And it sounds like a resounding yes.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's gotten to the point now where quite often even my dreams are not in English anymore.
Yeah.
It's a pretty nice thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned your friends doing the podcast. Like, are there resources for Native Americans, First Nations people, who maybe young people who want to dip more into their culture and maybe into the world of music that may not have those in their immediate surroundings? Like, are there forums or Facebook groups, or how do you guys connect?
I mean, I can only speak from the community that I'm involved in, which is the Tsimshian community, Somalic speaking community. We're fortunate enough that there are a couple online groups that are just full of people that want to learn the language, that want to learn more about the culture. Because a lot of us are spread out. A lot of us are, you know, like we are a border nation where, some of us are in Alaska, but also there are people, you know, as far as like Alabama, there's Tsimshian people that are hanging out there, Florida, Washington, you name it. So having the online community for that really definitely helped bring people together, give them a sense of community, you know, a sense of belonging in reconnecting to the culture and the language.
Yeah. And when this record comes out, are you going to tour it? Are you going to do shows?
Yeah, that's the plan. I've got a pretty jam-packed summer already, touring mostly here. I definitely want to take this show to Alaska, where there's a lot of us. I definitely want to take it to Washington, Oregon, you know, all around, kind of like, what is it that people call it? Cascadia?
Yeah. Cascadia.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of want to do a Cascadia tour in the long run.
And when you're playing these shows, are they at like honky tonk, alt country, Americana, whatever it's called, clubs, or is it more cultural centers, or is it kind of a mix?
Yeah, it's a bit of everything. Even to small, you know, like 35 seat cafes. Mm-hmm. Anywhere from that to big music festival stages. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. Eventually I want to do a village tour. That I'm in the works, or like that is in the works now. To visit all of the small remote Tsimshian villages along the coast. That'll be pretty cool.
That sounds like the makings of a great documentary.
Could be. Got to find somebody with a camera.
I'm sure you know somebody. That sounds amazing.
Mm.
When you do these shows, do you explain in English what the songs are about, or do you just kind of let the songs speak for themselves?
It depends who's there. For the most part, I will have to at bare minimum be like the chorus is this. But sometimes I get to have a little fun, especially if I remember to do it, is just to say, you know, what the chorus is and invite people to sing along, which is, you know, that's totally classic folk tradition. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's nice because for a lot of people that are there, you know, they might not be Tsimshian and they might not be attached to our territory. But it's still a part of just keeping the language going. The more that the more people that are speaking it, albeit, you know, they might know a phrase or two.
Yeah.
It might be their first time speaking it at my show, which is kind of cool. But there are places where there are speakers and of the language where I've played, even in Vancouver. And most oftentimes they're like, yeah, I will be listening to your song and then turning to their friend next to them and being like, he's saying this. You know, and they'll be translating in the audience on the fly, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you go English for the between song banter, or you just go straight through?
Yeah, I will. Except for here. And that's in Khan, because there's a lot of speakers still here. When I was first performing all of these songs, I did so last year. And I didn't, for my whole in-between banter, I didn't speak a word of English.
Incredible.
And I do a fair bit of storytelling in my stage banter. Mm-hmm. No English here.
You're kind of a multi-instrumentalist. How many instruments do you take out on the road with you, and what does the band look like, if there is a band?
So when I perform solo, I'll have a acoustic guitar, fiddle. I haven't been taking my banjo out as much as it would like to be taken out. It's kind of been sitting around. Mm-hmm. But I'll switch between those. Sometimes I'll have my mandolin if I feel like bringing that. I get bored very quickly. So oftentimes if I wrote a song on the guitar, I'll be like, oh, maybe I'll just rearrange it for the banjo, or, you know, rearrange it so I can fiddle and sing at the same time, kind of thing. When I'm with a band, it's all like, I just play electric guitar and that's it. And we're a three piece, just drums, bass, and guitar. And, that feels really good too. I like just playing just like a dancey kind of show. Well, to get people dancing with a full band, you know?
Yeah. Telecaster. I don't even know. What are you playing? Electric.
Uh-huh. As we are for our journal. I was really hoping I would get a good question about
took a while, but we got there.
I'm getting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I am actually playing my grandpa's old 1960 something Tysco hollow body. So it's a funny, kind of a funny looking 335 copy. Mm-hmm. It had a horrible tailpiece and trim system that didn't make sense. So I took that off and threw that out and threw a Bigsby on there. And it's got these wonderful, just old, raunchy sounding single coils. It's two single coils. Uh-huh. But yeah, that's what I play. I love it. And my grandpa used to play it a lot. I don't remember seeing it myself, but my older brother remembers grandpa playing that. He used to play dances and stuff a long time ago. But yeah, like I said earlier, he still performs, still plays. So cool. Yeah, that's my pride and joy, is my 60s Taisko made in Japan.
I love it. I mean, there must be a guitar store or two if a town has that many people, right?
No, we have like the classic like Radio Shack / like, or like electronic store on one side with TVs and all other kind of electronic junk. And then the other side has like really cheap, like Beaver Creek Junker guitars and, you know, only Dean Markley string, and they don't carry anything else. Like kind of, yeah. So we have to go pretty far. The closest actual music store is an hour and a half drive from here.
To where?
To Terrace. That's another town of Terrace, 12,000 people or so. Yeah.
I've heard of Terrace. They have skiing, if I remember. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. James Mountain.
Yeah.
A lot of deep powder.
How'd you get the name Saltwater Hank?
That one, it started when, like, I was just like, oh, I just can't be Jeremy Paul, especially if, at the time I thought I was going to be sneaky, and I didn't know about the J Treaty yet. So I was going to be like, well, if I'm going to go across the border and play shows, and I've played a lot of shows under the name Jeremy Paul, then they'll Google me and they'll realize that I'm going to play shows, and then I won't be able to cross the border. So I had to come up with his name, but then I realized I don't actually have to do that. And like with the J Treaty and being a border nation, I can just show up and be like, hello, I am indigenous. I'm crossing for the J Treaty. I don't need a work permit and I can stay here for as long as I can. And then they'll be like, okay, cool. Here you go.
Okay.
Which is nice.
Mm-hmm. And when you say crossing border, like this is so counterintuitive to me because, but I mean, you're trying to go play shows in like Ketchikan or in Alaska, mm-hmm. right? Is that what you're talking about? Yeah. That's so wild. I mean, that would be the nearest American club to you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah. And I've done that, and it was surprisingly smooth. I was just like, hi, here is my documentation proving my indigenous ancestry, and I'm here to work and play and live for as long as I want. And they're like, welcome to America.
Awesome. You didn't even need a pseudonym.
No. Yeah. But, yeah, I got it anyway, but yeah, being a saltwater person, like the Tsimshian were saltwater people.
Yeah.
That's where that comes from. You know, we're just, it's just a few minute walk out the door and the ocean is right there for me. So we've always been so connected to the ocean. The ocean is what gives us food and life. And then the Hank part is, I could have been another one, but I wasn't. I was a Jeremy. But my dad is Henry, and his nickname is Hank. And he was named after his great uncle, Hank.
Okay. The country runs strong. Yeah.
Yeah. I could have been Hank 3.
There you go. I think that's been taken.
Another Hank 3. Yeah, it's been taken. Yeah. I could have been Hank 3 in parentheses, another one in close parentheses.
Yeah. Yeah. Now that this is done, have you already started writing more songs in the language?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I've got four on the go. Three. Two, three, two that have been performed already with the band. But yeah, there's four new ones coming up. Coming up, we're going to have to record again this October.
I love it. Very cool. Do you have a recording studio where you are?
No. But fortunately, you know, being remote and being where we are, we've got and like my friends that play with me, we're all recording engineers in our own right.
Okay.
And the place that we recorded was pretty cool. We recorded the record in a big cedar longhouse, which is the traditional dwelling of our people.
Yeah.
So, and there, needless to say, the reverb in that place is just delicious.
I bet.
Like, it's just like, it's really long. Well, it's long in sound and big, but quick in decay. So it's just like this big shot of reverb, and then it's just like poof, and it's gone.
Yeah,
it's wild. So you can hear that in mostly in the vocals and in the drum cymbals on the record, because we really like wanted to lean into that.
Yeah,
that room.
It's like its own instrument. It's really cool.
Fully, yeah, yeah.
Well, Saltwater Hank, thank you. This was eye-opening. The record is fantastic. You know, you obviously you don't need to speak the language to just know that it's great songs and a great message there. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much. Yeah, thanks for having me too.
All right, that was my conversation with Saltwater Hank. I hope you enjoyed it. Again, incredible artist. This record is awesome. Check it out, and we'll have regularly scheduled podcasts like normal, one a week going forward. Stay tuned. If you like our show, as always, leave us a review over on Apple Podcasts.